Yeah, right. Didn't hear anything. And now, so... I believe I don't tread on anyone's toes here in this room when I say everyone has more or less the same conceptual model about web application development in his head. You develop some server code, you develop some client code to be run in the browser, you design some nice HTML pages, and then you deploy all on this on a server that's more or less under your control, to a certain degree at least. And people using your shiny new application fetch it from that server together with all the user-generated data, which is profile information, metadata, uploaded images, uploaded documents, all that stuff. This data is stored on your server too. The majority of today's web applications is driven by such user-generated content like Facebook and Dropbox and all that stuff, and GitHub. And one consequence of that deployment model I just outlined is that the creation of the content itself is decentralized because every user creates some parts of the content, and the storage and the profit from the data is centralized on a single server or by a single vendor. Do you have to say something that more people in this room are ought to hear? And do you want to share a piece of information with other people over the internet? What are your choices then? I outlined two options that you have. The first one is you do it all yourself. You get a web server, you get a software to run on, like a blogging platform software, a DNS name, which is kind of important, and I'm going to detail on that later on, and a constant internet connectivity. Now, this is sometimes hard to imagine for web developers like us who do this all the time, but doing this, taking option one, requires a huge amount of knowledge. Like my mother and my grandma, they can't rent a server and deploy some blogging software on that server to have access to the content. So they probably tend to using option two. Let someone else do it. Like in a drive-thru, you take advantage of a one-stop third-party solution for getting your content published on the internet. We have a wide range of services to choose from, which is Dropbox, Facebook, GitHub, Flickr, just to name the most obvious ones and the biggest ones. But by doing this, you lock yourself into a platform that you have no control whatsoever about. You don't even have ownership of the namespace you used to reach your content, right? This is the URL. The namespace, like facebook.com/, I don't know, your profile, is owned by Facebook. And if you want to migrate your data from Facebook to another platform, you can't make your profile accessible via facebook.com/ your profile name anymore, because Facebook owns that namespace. Now, how about we take back control over the content that we create? How about we leverage the decentralized structure of the internet and the web like it was ever, and create a user-controlled infrastructure for content creation, publishing, addressing, and sharing? And this is what I'm going to talk about today. Over the last 2.5 years, my colleague and I at the university, we developed a user-centric architecture for decentralizing content creation, content storage, addressing, and distribution all inside your browser. And the main building block for this decentralized platform is WebRTC. You know, the Internet Explorer and the Safari logos are a bit ahead because they don't implement WebRTC right now. But they will, sooner or later. I'm going to talk about this later. WebRTC is like the new buzzword on the web, and it's kind of hard to get a hand on what WebRTC actually is. So I went to the internet, what do you usually do, and try to find a resolution is really bad, but right, I hope you can read all the stuff. Yeah. I went to the internet and fetched some definitions of what WebRTC actually is. The first one is from the WebRTC.org website, which is hosted by Google. And it says, WebRTC is a free open project that provides browsers and mobile applications with real-time communications capabilities via simple APIs. The second one is from Wikipedia, and it says WebRTC is an API definition drafted by the World Web Consortium that supports browser-to-browser applications for voice calling, video chat, and file sharing without the need of either internal or external plugins. And the third definition here is from TalkBox, very big user of WebRTC. They deployed WebRTC applications on the internet already, and they are profiting from it. And they say WebRTC is a communication standard developed by the W3C in close cooperation with the RTC Web standard developed by the ITF. RTC Web functions at a lower protocol layer. WebRTC enables the embedding of this function in application and websites. The protocol is commonly used to support voice over chat between peers. So we have three different definitions that relate to the same thing, which is WebRTC, but they focus on different targets, you know? And this is like the problem, because WebRTC is a really huge thing and it's not easy to get a handle on it. So it's a project. It's an API. It's a communication standard, and that's the thing which I think is most clearly WebRTC communication standard. It consists of APIs and protocols and all that stuff. But to make things simple, I drew up a graphic, like I always do when I want to grab things and I want to understand things. And this is how web applications right now function. There's no WebRTC involved. Like, this is WebRTC. This comes later, right? So you have a browser here. You have a browser here. You have JavaScript, HTML DOM stuff. They communicate to the server and send data to the server that is relayed to the other browser and other stuff. So you have chat application, for example, and when you send a message to the other user, it gets sent to the server, and the server sends it back to the other user. Now here comes WebRTC. It bridges the gap that we have here when two users want to communicate with each other, right? We have a channel, a communications channel for audio video, and for file sharing and generic data stuff, directly between the two browsers. This is all that WebRTC brings us. And I've conducted this table, which I think sums this up quite good. So actually right now, before WebRTC, we had actually three communications APIs in the browser. The first one is HTTP, which everyone of you knows. It's asynchronous. It's not asynchronous, but if you use AJAX, it's asynchronous, all right? It's a client-server architecture because you have a browser, sends a GET request or POST request or another HTTP request to the server, and the server answers this request. So it's unidirectional. The server can't send an HTTP request to your browser. The second thing is server-send events, which I don't know. Who of you knows server-send events? Right. Who of you uses server-send events? Two of you. Right. I really like server-send events because it's actually a push channel from the server to the client and nothing more. It's that simple. It's better for WebSocket if you just want to have push to your client. Because it doesn't come with that overhead of WebSockets. But also, it's client-server only. you can open a server send events connection to your server, and it then can send unidirectionally events to your client. The third one is WebSockets. I think most of you know WebSockets. It's a bidirectional channel between a client and a server, so browser and a web server. But it's the client server, right? So here comes WebRTC. It has all the same capabilities when it comes to asynchronicity and bidirectional communication. But the important thing is this. It's peer-to-peer. Like I had it on the slide here, right? You have a direct channel between two browsers, and all the data that you send through this channel is never seen by the server. And that's important for the framework I'm going to describe later. So to sum this up, WebRTC is this. It enables direct communication between two browsers, and it comes with a lot of technical stuff underneath. First thing is you have NAT traversal, which is so important if you want to have peer-to-peer communication. Because without NAT traversal, you probably won't reach like 90% of internet users today. I don't know. But it's a huge, huge percentage of users that are behind some NAT gateway, like network address translation, right? And WebRTC handles all of this for you. And this is really hard, as I've seen over the last 3 years when the IETF standardized the NAT traversal stuff of WebRTC. It's really hard to do. And still, you have WebRTC clients which can't be reached using WebRTC because the NATs are, they're called full cone NATs, and they can't be reached from the outside. They can't open a port and say, okay, talk to me via this port. This just doesn't work, and it never will, right? But all the other NATs are traversable using WebRTC. So you have no intermediary server for the communication. For the connection setup, you will need a server. I'll talk about this. But once you have the channel, you won't need a server anymore. You can disconnect from the server completely. Very important thing, you have secure transfer protocol for audio and video data. All the WebRTC, all the other data that is sent to a WebRTC channel is encrypted by default, and you will not be able to not send encrypted data, right? This is very important because the IETF working group had hard discussions about this. How they are going to encrypt the channel, how they are going to exchange the keys for the encryption. I was at the IETF meeting in Berlin, I think in 2013, and it was even an emotional discussion what key exchange mechanism they are going to use. And they chose the mechanism that is actually the most secure, which is SCTP DTLS. Never mind about the terminology. It's the mechanism where it uses Diffie-Hellman key exchange, so the server won't be able to get the keys used for the encryption. And there was another standard proposed to exchange the keys, which is called SDES, and exchanges the keys via the server. This is known from SIP. I don't know who's from the VoIP world. They probably know SDES. So SCTP DTLS is used, and it makes the channel most secure. As I've said, if you come from the VoIP world, you will probably know what SDP and offer answer is. I will explain this later. And you have optional source authentication. This is a thing that is standardized but not implemented right now, and it's optional for your application to use. But let's just say it is there. And to enable all this stuff, they included in the browsers this huge pile of technology, right? When Firefox... I developed some WebRTC code in Firefox, and when they started including WebRTC in the browser, it was like 10 thousands lines of code, right? They included a complete SIP stack. SIP is the session initiation protocol used for VoIP calling, voice over IP. And they included this whole library to work on that, because it's very similar to how WebRTC works. We have communication completely over UDP, which is different from all the other communication we have right now in the browsers, or we had before WebRTC. And UDP is used because we want to have real-time capabilities. We want to have real-time audio and video chat. And UDP is the way to go when you want to have that, right? We have ICE. It's on top here. I don't know if that's really correct. There are very different schemas of this stack. Sometimes ICE is just besides here because it only helps you initiate a connection. But actually, programmatically, ICE is a layer, right? They say, okay, give me a connection, and ICE returns the connection, the ICE library. You have DTLS on top, which is very similar to TLS. So, pardon? ICE is the interactive communication exchange. Is that right? Let's roll this up. It actually makes all the NUT traversal stuff, right? It encapsulates stun and encapsulates turn. I think it's a bunch of 3, 4, 5 RFCs. You can read that if you like. It's not very handy, and it doesn't make very much fun to read that. And it encapsulates all the strategies you have for traversing a NUT using stun or a turn server. Yes. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, exactly. When you say ICE, connect me somewhere, it actually returns a list of IP addresses. Yeah, right. And we have RTP on top, which is also known from VoIP. It's the real-time transport protocol. We have the secure version of RTP here, and only the secure version. And we have the media stream API on top, which is actually the API that you are going to use when you want to initiate audio or video chat, audio video connection. Partly, yes, because everything for itself is already there, right? But taking this all together and making it work with each other is not very easy, and they develop new RFCs for that. And we have a data channel API, which is the API used for generic data transfer, which is not audio and not video, so you can send strings and blobs and all that stuff, JavaScript blobs. And SCTP is the transfer protocol used for exchanging that data. And on top of SCTP, you have the data channel API that you are going to use in the browser, in your JavaScript application. So actually, for example, here we have for the communication between SCTP and DTLS and UDP, there are standards that are called SCTP over DTLS, because normally you would run DTLS over SCTP to gain the capabilities of SCTP, which is multi-homing and all that stuff. But they said, okay, we don't need that. We just put SCTP on top of DTLS. And they developed a new RFC for that, a new standard. Does everyone know what an RFC is? Right. An RFC is a request for comments. It's actually not a standard. The ITF develops the standard, the Internet Engineering Task Force, and they don't want it to be called standard, but I'm just going to stick to standard, and because everyone sees the RFCs as standard. And they develop protocols for the internet. Yeah. And mechanisms and all that stuff. So what's, basically what you need to know is the media stream API and the data channel API. And let's take a look at how these work. WebRTC gets you an RTCP connection object that you can instantiate. In older browsers, it's called mods RTCP connection or WebKit RTCP connection. I think most current versions, or at least the most current versions, have removed the prefix, so you can just instantiate an RTCP connection. And then you do some magic on it. First thing is the channel is something we just say we have. It can be a WebSocket channel. It can be, I don't know, an XMPP channel or an email channel, if you like. The important thing is you instantiate PC, like RTCP connection, and you create an offer. I said to the signaling to connect two browsers is called offer answer. So you create an offer, and then the ICE stuff starts working and collects all the IP addresses you are reachable at. Can be local IP addresses or remote, like internet reachable IP addresses, whatever is appropriate for your web browser, for your host. And you just call create offer, and a huge bunch of technology starts working for you, which is like the stack. And you provide and create offer call, which is just a JavaScript function. Say set local description, which says, okay, this is the peer connection with this offer. And you send this offer to Bob. In this case. And Bob receives this on a channel, which is an arbitrary channel, and says set remote description using your offer, right? And so it sees, okay, there is someone who wants to connect to me, and his offer looks like this. And then you say, okay, I want to connect. You can have logic here, but let's just say you want to connect to everyone wanting to connect to you. You create an answer, and provide this function, the create answer callback. You create an answer and send this answer right back on the channel you have. Let's say it's a WebSocket. So we have client Alice sending the offer to the to Bob. Bob accepts this offer, sends the answer back, and then we have an RTCP connection. Actually, we have a WebRTC connection, right? Yes. It depends. I'm not actually talking about audio video calling here, because I want to talk about like decentralizing the web without audio video calls. When you want to get access from your application to the user's microphone, to the user's speakers, you say get media stream, I think, and then a door hanger or pop-up appears in the browser, and it says, okay, this application wants to access your microphone, wants to access your speakers, right? And then you have to acknowledge that, and then it can actually create the offer or the answer. So there's user interaction involved when you are using audio-video calling. But we want to focus on data channels, and there's no user interaction involved. Let's not talk about privacy and security here right now. Let's just accept that. We can talk about this and discuss about this later on. I say I have a peer connection here. I've created the peer connection using new window RTC peer connection. And I want to create a data channel on that peer connection. You have no address, right? Oh, right, yeah. The thing is, the signaling, like the saying, how do I know which user I have to send my offer to? It's not part of the standard. It's completely out of scope from the standard, right? They explicitly wanted to do this because they wanted to say every application can address, can identify its users like it wants to address them, and yeah.
Did you say every application
Yeah, actually, it's a JavaScript application. So you got to fetch it from somewhere, right? I'm going to show you how this is done later. It's a simple web application using JavaScript APIs just like any other web application right now. And you can implement the signaling as you wish. And you can say, okay, I wanna have, like I said, that channel doesn't have to be a WebSocket channel. It can be an email channel, for example. And you can send an offer via email, accept the offer, like somehow cut and paste and all that stuff. We did that while debugging. And yeah, it's completely out of scope of the standard. So addressing the user is not part of WebRTC. It just says, okay, I have this IP address and this port that I can be reached on, and I want to have this SCTP port opened and that SRTP port opened, and then and then I can initiate the connection. All right. And then I have this WebRTC connection. I want to create a data channel. I want to send data to the other user, like a string. Like, hi, Bob. And I just say create data channel. And when the data channel is opened, my open callback function is called, and I can send data on the channel. On the other side, Bob says, OK, when someone wants to initiate, or when Alice on this peer connection wants to initiate data channel connection, I say, OK, I accept that. And the data channel is part of the event. It's the target of the event. And when a message comes in, I alert the user with the message. It's that simple. It's a huge technology stack just to having like two or three JavaScript calls, right? This one? You have a peer connection already to Alice. Like, you have a WebRTC channel, and Alice says, okay, I want to have a data channel. And then Bob's browser fires this event, this data channel event. And then you can say, okay, I'll accept the data channel or not, right? Okay, don't be scared by this. If you have never seen this, it's not that important, but for completeness, I want to show it. This is an offer sent by one browser to another browser. So when I say create offer, like I said here, create offer. This is created. It's just a string. It's SDP, session description protocol, and it contains all the stuff needed for opening a WebRTC data channel in this case. So as you can see here, there are candidates for IP addresses. We have the local IP address here, and we have a remote. It's a server reflexive address, so it's an address for which you can be reached from the outside. And all this stuff is sent over to Bob, and then he knows how to connect to you. So this is very much into detail now, but most of the cases when you are developing WebRTC applications, you don't have to mangle with these. In the past, browsers were not very compatible with each other. So users and programmers had to tweak a little bit on the SDP generated and stuff, and do some magic with it, so that, for example, Chrome understands the offer that Firefox generates and stuff. And you can see the second line contains Mozilla SIP UA, and you see it's just a SIP stack. I don't know if they exchanged it in the past, but when I created this offer, it still had the user agent Mozilla SIP UA. So let's take a breath and think about how can we actually use this to take our control back over our data. And this is where the thing that I created over the last 2.5 years comes into play. And it's called Boblish. It's short for browser-based open publishing. We didn't come up with a better name, so we just stick with it. And actually does this. It creates a peer-to-peer network between browsers, and not all of these browsers has a server connection. Just the one there has a WebSocket connection to the signaling server. All the other browsers don't have a connection to the server that they fetch the applications from. So you connect once to the server, fetch all the HTML, JavaScript, CSS stuff, and then you can close the connection and be part of the peer-to-peer network. And no data exchanged in this peer-to-peer network is sent to the server, right? That was the first prototype we developed, and it's a full mesh. Yeah, right. Not at all. So what we did was we exchanged that full mesh with the DHT, with the Cort DHT. But I'm going to talk about this. So what do we need to actually have a peer-to-peer network that lets take us the control over our data back? So we thought about it and came up with these three main requirements. The first one is you need a routing layer for routing the data. You need content names. Like I said, Dropbox.com is owned by Dropbox, and you can migrate your content to somewhere else and stick with the name. So you need a proprietary name, which is bound to your name, to your ownership, and a name resolution mechanism to have mobility and all that stuff. And you need a simple API. I really like the WebRTC API because it's that simple to use, like I showed. So we want to come up with a simple API. At the what? We didn't take specifically a look at Freifunk, but we took a look at how a performant routing network peer-to-peer can be implemented, like Batman or they're using Batman still? All right. We came up with another solution. First thing was we built a prototype for having a simple routing mechanism. So we have these three peers. They are connected. Peer 1 is connected to peer 2, and peer 2 is connected to peer 3 via a data channel, a WebRTC data channel. And now peer 1 wants to connect to peer 3 using peer 2, like using just the data channel it has, because it has no server connection. And so we came up with a mechanism that creates the offer and sends the offer via the data channel, and not via an external signaling mechanism, like it's done with all other applications right now. They just use the server to exchange signaling. So if you lose connection to the server, you're screwed. And so we said, all right, we want to have signaling inside our peer-to-peer network. So it's that simple. You create an offer. Peer 1 creates an offer, sends it to peer 2, which is the only peer connected to peer 1, and says, all right, send this offer to peer 3. Somehow, I don't care how, part of the routing protocol. And peer 2, hey, it apparently is connected to peer 3, so it sends the offer directly to peer 3. Peer 3 accepts the offer, sends the answer back via peer 2, and voila, you have a data channel connection. Yeah, this is something you have to implement. Pardon? Yes. The thing is, identity and security is you're actually completely on your own when you want to implement privacy, identity, and security in a WebRTC application. That has advantages and it has disadvantages. In the conclusion, I'll get to that, right? Because we thought about that too. Okay, routing is done, more or less. Actually, let's say it works. Yeah, you can use a peer-to-peer network to send offers and answers. Now we want to name the content that is inside the peer-to-peer network, the Boblish network. And we came up with the requirements that names have to be location independent. So if I have my cell phone, like where is it here, my cell phone, and I have some content that I publish from my cell phone, And now I want to migrate that content to my laptop and publish the data from the laptop under the same name. The name has to be location independent. This is different from DNS because in DNS, names are location bound, right? You have an IP address, you have a DNS name, and the IP address is actually, it sticks to the host. There are ways to make DNS like location independent, but these are more or less hacks and they are not really real time because DNS has a propagation delay. And yeah, said that we want to have easy replication and migration. So we want to have perhaps our data published from my cell phone and published from my laptop at once, right? So we said, okay, we want to use URIs because users know what URIs are, like more or less they know how they look like and they say, oh, that's a URL. Okay, it's a URI, but all right. Let's not be picky. So we created a scheme for names in Boblish. And it is a scheme Bob because shorter than Boblish and our professor didn't like Boblish. Okay, we said, okay, let's stick with Bob. And you have username at IDP. Which is like proprietary to our Boblish solution. It has nothing to do with WebRTC. We just said, okay, we want to have like this name so we can have identity, some identity solution, which is like encoded in the name. And we can say, okay, username at IDP. The IDP can be like, let's say facebook.com when you want to use Facebook for identifying you. And then you implement a protocol for asserting the identity. Actually, we didn't implement that right now because we stick with the other cases. But in the URI, it's already like included and we can put it on top. And then you have column protocol, which is just a string and it's like a port in TCP. So how does the name resolution work? As you said, a full mesh doesn't scale. I don't think anyone is wonders why it doesn't scale. And you can only have like 64 or 100 WebRTC connections in one browser instance. And so we came up with using a DHT. DHTs are distributed hash table and they are just a distributed key value store. You have a network of peers, and you say, all right, I want to store key X under the value Y in the peer-to-peer network, and the peer-to-peer network does all the stuff for you, the DHT. Here's a very simple graphic of how a CORD DHT works. CORD is a DHT implementation. It's not quite new, but it works, and it's very scalable. And it works like this. You have all these dots are nodes in your peer-to-peer network. So they are browsers in Boblish. And every node, every browser has an ID and stores like jump points in its finger table. It's like a routing table from like logarithmically. So we can search the peer-to-peer network logarithmically. So you don't have, you're not as performant like a full mesh when it comes to lookup because it has a complexity of 1. But you have a complexity, a logarithmic complexity here, looking up keys and looking up hosts for keys. And so every host is responsible for a specific key space. This node 38 is responsible for the key space here, and every key has an ID, which is part of the circle, like from 0 to 64, and 38 is responsible for storing the keys for 38 or from 33 to 38, right? So if you're storing something under key 37, it's stored on this node, the value. Right? So this is a simple peer-to-peer network using CORD. The thing we liked about CORD and DHTs as such are that the API is very simple too. And we like simple API. You just call put on your distributed hash table implementation with the key and the value. You can call remove to remove the key. You can get the key, and the value is somehow is returned. We don't care how; it's implementation specific, and so we stick with that. And the API that concludes all this is that this is a simple Boblish client in the peer-to-peer network. You fetch JavaScript as a user. You fetch the JavaScript which contains this code, and you instantiate as a developer a Boblish client, saying, "Okay, what is the signaling server? This is a WebSocket signaling server." And when you're connected to the peer-to-peer network, which includes you have an ID, you have got an ID, and you are part of the court ring and all that stuff, then the onConnect method is called, and you can do whatever you like when you are connected to a peer-to-peer network. And what you can do then is, I said, we have this protocol here, so every client can run different protocols inside a Boblish network. And you can say, all right, register this protocol, which is group chat here. So when you have a group chat application, and you want to say, okay, I want to be reachable at the protocol group chat. So the URI would be bob colon user at example.com slash group chat, colon group chat. And then you can receive messages on this protocol, right? So every client does this and can also call, oh, I didn't include that. Every client can also send data on this protocol. And now don't be scared. This is how Boblish looks like when it's done and implemented and running. We have three nodes here. Alice at example.org, Bob at example.com, and Carol at example.com. All are part, all have a name, an ID, and all are part of the DHT, of the court ring. Right, so they have this connection here. Alice is key 3, Bob is key 9, and Carol is key 1. And now Alice has this name, Alice at example.org, and hosts different applications and different data on the client. For example, a chat room 1, we have here under the protocol chat. We have a protocol document running on this host, serving the file pcar.png, and we have a search protocol implemented here, and you can host, for example, search slash asterisk TNG asterisk, so people can search for stuff on your host. And the name resolution now is part of the DHT. So we don't store the content in the DHT, but we store only key and value pairs which say, okay, Alice has this ID. And then we can say, okay, connect me to ID 3, right? So we have mobility here because when Alice moves somewhere else or Alice wants to host her content from another host, just joins the DHT and sets a new value there in the fingertable of all the hosts and says, okay, Alice at example.org is now reachable at key 5, right? Hosted, the DHT is like formed. So the question was, where's the DHT hosted? The DHT is hosted nowhere, right? The DHT is made up of all the peers. It's like a virtual model, right? You have a peer-to-peer network. I don't want to go too far, right? You have a peer-to-peer network, and they form a DHT, right? Using this API. Yes. Everyone hosts a little part of the DHT. Every host has some key and value pairs, and so they form up the DHT. And Cort has a routing layer too for you, so it's there's a very easy to read paper on the internet which explains Cort. It's actually the first paper on Cort. The inventors of Cort wrote it, and it's very easy to read, very easy to implement too. That's because we used Cort. There are better ones, like Camellia, for example. But code is like easy to implement, and our architecture of Bublish is structured so that we can exchange code with Camellia, for example, very easily. Yes. Yes. The thing is, you are right. That's like part of a peer-to-peer network. I always forget that. The question was, when one host gets down, a part of the key space gets lost, right? And you have to rearrange the key space. There are very many papers on having replication inside a DHT, not only Cort, but other DHTs. So we can say, all right, Alice hosts some keys and replicates the data across the ring so that the probability that all the data gets lost when a host gets down is nearly zero. I mean, when every but one host loses connection to the network, you're kind of screwed, right? But in a big peer-to-peer network, this is actually not going to happen. Just let's say this. Okay, this is very technically, and I think we won't go deeper on that. It's just a sketch, and if you want to know more about how we implemented that, you can ask the questions later. I'm just going to show you what the use cases are for Bublish. Part of that I already said. They are document sharing, content search, real-time chat. These are three use cases we implemented. Document sharing is very nice because of the quote. Every time you email a file to yourself so we can pull it on your friend's laptop, Tim Berners-Lee sheds a single tear, right? File sharing is so stupidly difficult still. And we said, okay, we want to make it easy. We want to have a host which is part of Bublish and just says, okay, I want to publish this file, get a URL, and done, right? And this is how it works. The host is max at example.org. I forgot the protocol. It's here. You put here colon document just mentally. And you have a URI. So you upload a file like to your application. You have to implement that, like uploading file, reading the file from the local file system and stuff, generating the URI. But then you have a URI for sharing that document, and you share that URI like via Jabber or email. The other user you wanna send the file to boots up his Bublish application, types in this URI, and the file is fetched using Bublish. Right? You can even implement parameters, and you can say, okay, the checksum of the file must be so-and-so, so you can have checksums and all that stuff. Content search is another use case we came up with. All right, I forgot the protocols in every use case. You can search for files. You can implement file searching applications and say, okay, I don't know the URI. I want to search on the host's shared files. You can implement a real-time chat and say, okay, I'm Alice. I want to host a chat group. The room is called room one. The URI is generated for me. You can probably read it. It's printed out here. It's called Star Trek chat in this example. And then Alice sends this URI to another user, boots up his Bublish application, and joins the chat room, right? So where can you see this thing at work? This like kind of complex thing. We published all that stuff on GitHub. We have an organization called Bublish on GitHub, which hosts core and demos and some other stuff. Also an emulation component where you can emulate a Bublish network using Node.js. We use that for doing some evaluation on performance and stuff. And I can't ascertain that this works right now, because one problem is that WebRTC is a standard like work in progress, very much in progress, right? And the API like changes with every major browser version. So I can't make sure that the core library works, right? So if you have a problem with that, just issue a pull request at best, or just open an issue and we'll get to that. And yeah. So 45 minutes are over, or a bit more. And I want to take some questions if you like. Short recap. We have created Boblish, which provides a framework for distributed content communities. That's what we're calling it. And it's as simple as using boblish.js in your application, calling the Boblish client API, and you're part of a DHT, right? Of a P2P network, right? The thing is, our experience from the last 3 years is that WebRTC is cumbersome at times. I hope that this will get better. I don't know. Because browser vendors are like a bit picky about what they want to implement and what they don't want to implement, how they want to implement ICE and stun and all that stuff. So like I said, sometimes the library works, sometimes the library doesn't work, and you have to adapt it to make it work. And in the early days, Firefox couldn't connect to Chrome because the SDP parsing was different, and yeah, all that stuff. If you are interested in the WebRTC progress, you should join the ITF RTC Web mailing list. It's called RTC Web because they don't want to rename it to WebRTC. And it's a very early historic name. I really encourage you to join the mailing list because it's very interesting what they are discussing there. We have quite a bit of to-dos for Boblish. For example, mobility, like fastly switching between peers which have the same ID. Content offloading, like saying, I'm hosting the content on my cell phone, but I'm going to turn my cell phone into flight mode, and I want to offload the content to another host. Peer-to-peer stability is really not an easy issue. It's not only our problem, it's a problem of peer-to-peer networks as such. We can improve on that. And security, which includes identity, privacy, and all that stuff. We didn't focus on that very much. And it's a completely different topic. Yeah. Right. You can like publish a paper on security with Boblish and having identity and privacy and all that stuff handled with Boblish. It is doable, but you just have to do it. And perhaps, we're gonna do it in our research group. I don't know. Yeah, so that's actually it. If you like, I'm going to take some questions if you have time. And also, yes. Yeah. The question was if you, as a user, have to acknowledge that a data channel is created. The answer is no. Every application you fetch from the internet can open a data channel to another peer without the user actually recognizing it. There's no acknowledgement about that. Pardon? Yeah, he said there's an option to disable WebRTC in Chrome. Yeah, of course, but then you don't have WebRTC, right? So you can't. you have to enable it. Go to the application you want to use, use the application, and then disable WebRTC again. I don't think it's something that my mom would do, right? You have a question. Yeah, of course. He said it does depend on DNS. Of course we depend on DNS. Because without DNS, you won't be able to fetch the application. But we reduced the dependence on DNS to the most viable minimum, right? So we said, as soon as you have joined the peer-to-peer network, you're not dependent on DNS anymore. You can load applications from the file system. We had some strange experience with that using WebRTC because they had like other permissions and stuff. But there are people doing this actually. There's on GitHub. There's an application that does this, a file sharing application that you can load from your file system and that uses some signaling server then joins another peer. Yeah, probably. Yeah, he said GNUnet is working on GNS? Right. GNU name system. Okay, I don't know that. I must admit. But yeah, it's like they're working on a client that's like a native client on platform, so right. It's not on the web. Okay. Yeah, the things, there are many applications, like there are many peer-to-peer applications, there are even BitTorrent clients implemented in WebRTC. I didn't test these, I didn't make any experiments on these, but there's very much going on in the peer-to-peer world using WebRTC, because you have browsers on every device, right? On every device that is connected to the internet, there's a browser. And so this device is probably can be a part of a peer-to-peer network. And this is something that we never had before, right? More questions? Yeah.
From my experience, ICE, the NAT transfer of ICE is quite reliable. But do you have any numbers on the hub? How many users have set up their NAT transfer?
No, I don't. The question is, do you have any numbers on when does ICE succeed and when does ICE fail, like the NAT traversal? I don't have any numbers. Google is doing very much experimentation on that, and they probably have current numbers. My experience from just a handful of tests is that in my company it didn't work, and at the university, funnily, it sometimes didn't work, right? At the university, we have static IP addresses, of course this works, but when you're behind a NAT at my university, which is in Hamburg, it didn't work. So I tested like 3 or 5 setups and 2 of them didn't work, which is 40%. I don't think it's that bad, like when you run a test on the internet, but yeah, perhaps there are numbers. I don't know about current numbers. Perhaps on the mailing list they have discussed a bit about delay between different locations of the world, and there was part of that was not traversal, but you have to search through the mailing list archive.
And how did the latency wanted in open network?
The thing is, an R evaluation. I have some stuff here. Let's look at the Gauss bootstrap performance. I won't go into very much detail here. This is the hop count. You have to bypass to initiate a connection, and this is the delay for the initial connection. And as you can see, with one hop count, you have a delay of more than 1 second. It stays at a level when you have reached a certain hop count, because with Boblish, you only have that much connections open. So as soon as you have 5 or 6 connections open in the cord in your finger table, you won't need to open any more WebRTC connections. So we handle that. And opening a WebRTC connection can last very long, seconds, because ICE is very verbose. Yes.
So I can compile all those WebRTC back into my database?
Yes. The question is, can I use WebRTC or Publish in a native application? And the answer is yes. Because first thing is WebRTC, Chrome has always had a single library, libWebRTC or libJingle, was called in the past. Which you can use in C and C++ applications. Firefox is working on tearing out all this huge stack of WebRTC to publish a C and C++ library. And the third thing is, or the second thing is, if you want, that you, like I said, we have an emulation running in Node.js. You can use that and like build a native application using Node.js, right? And having published one on Node.js. Yeah, I'm getting signaled that we are at the end. So if you want to discuss more, I'm here for some more minutes. And yeah, thank you for your attention.